Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears thanks to the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it hasn't been the greatest of weeks on planet Albion. Two games, 143% of possession, 40 shots, 14 of them on target, and, no goals, and just the 1 point, which leaves Roberto De Zerbi still looking for his first win. Good job the games get easier then, with us travelling to Champions Man City on Saturday before the manager Steelers come to the Amex the week after. Wouldn't it be just like Brighton, though, to get more points at the Etihad than we did against the side sitting bottom of the table? Joining me today as we look back on all of this and more is of course, Alan Wares. And we are delighted to welcome back Justin Brintnell. Hello, Justin. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a bit flat after the current form, but yeah.
I was about to say, is your glass half full, half empty, or have you smashed it on the bar?
No, it's half full, but there is a realisation there that we've taken one or two steps back potentially, but I think everything's in place to step forward again. It's just people have got to be patient.
Or as it was put to me after the game yesterday, when we were nattering about it in the West Stand upper, I said I felt there's a certain level of regression, and the chap I was speaking to say, I wouldn't say we've regressed, we've just gone back a little bit. There's a very fine distinction there between, but I'm not sure what it is.
It just seems to be all very, very frustrating because, I mean, the problem we've got here, I mean, and most football supporters have got short memories, let's face it. And like, you remember the good times and you forget that, you know, last season under Graham Potter, we went on that six game losing streak and, you know, and everything wasn't all rosy in the garden then. But then we found a way around it. Caicedo came into the side and we went on this amazing run towards the end of the season and the beginning of this season.
I remember people wanting Chris Hughton out on the day we played Aston Villa and could have won the second division, you know, the championship title. That's how fickle some people can be.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, but I mean, the problem we've got is our last memory of Graham Potter and Potter Ball in a Brighton shirt was that demolition of Leicester. And we've gone into the last few games. Obviously, the game at Liverpool, that's a standout. That was brilliant. But from supporters who only really see us at the Amex, you know, we've gone from that demolition of Leicester to the game against Spurs, which, okay, yes, it's Spurs, they're a decent side, and they're probably going to finish in the top four, then the Champions League. And then again, obviously against Nottingham Forest this week, they would have seen us against Brentford. And we're looking at the same players that were playing in that demolition of Leicester. And it's like,
how much store do you think we hold? You and me, AD, and possibly Justin, I'll bring him in on this. How much store do you think that we hold on the opinion that this team suddenly becomes terrible in 2 weeks? Irrespective of whether we've got a new manager. Justin, I mean, you know, as AD's pointing out, we tore Leicester a new one, played really well at Liverpool, could have, should have won. And here we are now struggling in front of goal. We haven't suddenly become rubbish overnight, have we?
No, not at all. And I think an interesting observation is to look at the last period of Potter's results. So that's from the end of last season after that barren run and the beginning of this season. And actually, the vast majority of those good results were against teams who have come to play football against Brighton and Hove Albion, not use this low block thing, which pretty much throughout Potter's time at Brighton, you come to Amex with a low block, you're almost guaranteed yourself a point, and it got us time after time after time. Fine, we beat Man United 4-0, we beat them away. Man United wanted to play football with us. They didn't stick everybody round the penalty spot and do the low block. I think Spurs got their early goal, then went into low block mode for 70 minutes. It was really effective. Brentford did the same. They thought, what we're going to do is we're going to take our chances. We're going to see what happens. We'll get a point if we do a low block, because that's the way you play Brighton. Cooper saw the Brentford performance, so right, low block. We might get, I don't think they had a shot on target, so, but they got their draw, and you can see by the style they play and they're going for the points. So I think we've always had, under Potter and now De Zerbi, managers will, you know, certain teams can't do it. Top six can't do the luck. Well, Conte can, but yeah, that is the way you get a draw against Brighton minimum. And we do not have the quality you need to break down a low block, in my opinion. And that hasn't changed.
I would just like to introduce a new rule for any of our listeners from overseas that, you know, if you are planning to make a trip to dear old Blighty and making your first trip to the Amex, probably best not to make it against the side that's bottom of the table, because our record against them, well, I can't remember the last time we scored a goal against a team that was bottom of the table. So
it's a statistical anomaly, AD. I mean, that's the end of it, really. I mean, you know, yeah, of course we've beaten teams at the bottom of the table in the great scheme of things. I mean, I fully agree with Justin's premise there. We, you know, a lot of those same sides play like that against the top six. We're probably going to against Manchester City. I mean, everyone's cacking themselves a little bit over that game, especially that RoboCop that they've now got playing for them. But yeah, they, you know, and the difference is that those top six sides are capable of breaking down, you know, as Justin puts it, the low block. They're capable of breaking down the parked bus with a bit more nurturing, a bit more care and consideration than we can. That's not to say we're not there.
I'm not going to argue with that, Al, but I mean, as De Zerbi said in his press conference yesterday, it's everything was okay. We've come against this season. We've come up against. Justin? Is it a coincidence that the goalkeepers always seem to have a worldie against us? Or is it just that we put it in places that it is easy for the goalkeeper to say? I mean, we're talking Raya, we're talking Pope, we're talking Henderson. I mean, all of these guys have absolutely had brilliant games against us. But that's down to our finishing, surely.
They're doing what I would expect them to do, Justin, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. I think for the low block tactic to work against Brighton, you need three things. You need luck. So
yeah, certainly.
And so basically, we're not going to score a deflection. You need a referee that's going to be complicit and not benefit Brighton too much. And then finally, you need Brighton players to miss chance after chance after chance. And looking at, in general, the Potter's results at Brighton Hove Albion, that is what we saw against bottom 10 teams, low block teams. We would miss chance after chance. And so not that much has changed. And I feel a bit sorry for De Zerbi, because it's like he comes in and suddenly it's back to this, let's do the low block against Brighton, because that's the way you guarantee a point and might nick a win.
There is an air of a psychological block about this as well. I mean, maybe the fan, whether the players feel it or not, we can't say. I mean, just because we feel X doesn't mean to say the players feel X. They might feel Y, and we don't know. But if we score in the first 5 minutes, then I wouldn't say we relax, but we, you know, the opposition has to reconsider their game plan. They have to look again. They have to come out a little bit more, and that will therefore benefit us. Look at what we did at Anfield. Scored twice in the first 15 minutes, and the game was just superb, and we were brilliant. And again, coulda, shoulda, won it. And in this instance, we had our chances in the first 5 minutes. I'm talking about both games, and we failed. We flunked them. And then you can see this kind of year-old or even six-month-old psychological block then taking hold, saying, well, every shot we have is going to end up in row Z. It's almost like there's this anti-magnet. And frankly, dear listener, you could go back to any one of our shows from the beginning of the year where we talk about how we've played, and you can then insert that into the certainly the Spurs, the Brentford and the Forest games.
Yeah, I think we've seen it so many times. We know after the first sort of three or four shots are missed, and the easy chance.
Not even saved.
We know there's going to be another 17 similar.
Okay, well, we're going to get back into this again shortly, but let's have a look back to Friday night, and let's start with Enoch Mwepu and the tribute to him from our players in the shirts that they were wearing, and that 15-minute chant that was going on.
Actually, AD, you were the one that was there. Could you actually confirm that it went all round the ground?
Basically, what happened was, I mean, I think that they were they started playing Seven Nation Army before the game anyway.
Right.
And Brighton fans were starting to sing something about Mwepu, but then the Brentford fans started singing something to their song that is Seven Nation Army.
Right.
And then Brighton fans took that on, and it just went on and on and on and on and on. And it was...
So Brentford fans were singing the same song, but just not the same words.
To be honest, I wasn't really paying an awful lot of attention to the Brentford fans because there was a game of football going on.
Well, yeah, fair enough. So it was okay. So we had Seven Nation Army going across the stadium, but not necessarily in tribute to Enoch.
Yeah, but it was quite a thing. And basically, we obviously we had Mwanangwa Zombe on the show last week, and he commented on the tributes, and he was quite taken aback by it, and as was most of Zambu, he says, and as was Enoch himself, who actually commented.
Absolutely.
And
you know,
and there's been, and actually the tributes keep coming this week to him. and it's like, you know, Fabrice Muamba, who obviously he had a major issue on the pitch and was technically dead for 60 odd minutes. And he's reached out to him. Eve Basuma's come out to him, and who's had heart conditions as well. You know, everyone's coming out to help him and offer any support that he needs. So, I mean, and that comes from us as well.
Well, this is the whole thing about what's he going to do next, and the upshot of it is, and I think we mentioned it last week, we don't know yet, and it's entirely up to him. And I don't think that the club is actually going to put any pressure on him one way or the other as to what he does do next. It's entirely in his hands. Within reason, but whatever it is, the nature of the character of who he is, you know, he'll make a success of it.
Yeah, and that's what everyone's saying as well, because he's just his drive to get to where he was now. I mean, the shirt said from Chambisi to the Premier League, your dream came true. Good luck.
Absolutely,
it was like it was just.
And we can fast forward that to Tuesday before the Forest game with the big sort of plastic Mwepu shirt on the pitch as well. So, you know, he is one of our own. Even though he was with us only it was about a year, but it felt like 5 minutes. But, you know, we feel he's one of our own. We all, of course, we're going to once again wish him well. And it's just kind of interesting to see how world football reacts to it. Like you said, when we had Ed Ahrens on at the same time last week, it was not just African, not Zambian football, not just African football, but world football. So, yeah. I'd love to have him back on here. Perhaps he can take my place.
Yeah. Talk more sense now.
Yeah. But, probably.
Okay. And then another thing, just a little anomaly that I picked out. I mean, Phil would be delighted with this one. It's a bit of a kit stat fart, this one.
Go on.
This was the first time, I haven't got the exact number of years, but it was the first time in the Premier League where the same kit has been worn by both sides in two seasons in a row.
Where did that little nugget come from?
Well, basically, it's one of those things. Brentford did a really good thing where they didn't actually change their home shirt like every other side does this year.
Yeah.
But basically, we always keep one of our second
shirt always becomes the following season's third shirt. Yeah.
And we wore the Hyperturk last season, and we did it this season. It's weird. Every other club has worn their new shirt or a different shirt.
People
are going to be dreaming about this stat now.
I know. I'm really glad I'm sitting down for it.
I know. This is what happens, Al, when we don't win.
Yeah, I know. We go clutching at just about everything else.
Yeah. Like I said, I've got rabbit holes written down here. I've got loads
please
of them.
Don't. Please you have don't. Been, let's you talk have about the misery warned. Of this game.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, look, I mean, in the game itself against Brentford, we, I mean, 72% of the possession, 21 shots, 7 on target. It's a, we made all the running in the game. And I mean, you're talking about a low block. I don't think Brentford were as negative, certainly not as negative as Forest, which we'll talk about later. But I mean, they did have opportunities themselves as well. But there was, it does seem to be, Justin, it's the same culprits missing. And I don't want to have a go
well,
at anybody.
It's not Neil Morpay this time. It's not Morpay.
No, it's not Morpay. But it's Solly
Listen,
March.
I'll tell you what's happening, AD. Yeah. We're having the same brilliant build-up. And then, Justin, tell us what happens.
It falls to... I made a comment to the chap sitting next to me. And the comment was along the lines of, the only player I'm happy to take a shot in this team at the moment is Trossard, because I don't trust anybody else.
Yeah.
It is a team effort. It is a team effort, this missing thing that we do.
Well, it's nice they take it in turns.
yeah.
But I think what doesn't help potentially is maybe two of the players who are better at shooting, Caicedo and McAllister, they're both kind of playing in quite deep midfield roles. Mm. So you are getting March and Lallana and players like that who have, as brilliant as they are in terms of game intelligent, passing, all of that sort of stuff, both of them, are they going to score more than one or two goals for the Albion a season? It's difficult to see, but there are other players as well. I think there is a fundamental, there's something wrong with the balance of our team, because we do not have enough players who can confidently score goals.
Shall I tell you what I think I see? And certainly since De Zerbi's taken over. So we've had a kind of there's an evolution, not a revolution. We haven't got a completely new style here. We do have, and I think this is a point that was made by Tom Hylands when we played at Anfield, is that we're going a lot more through the centre. Okay, fine. And the passing, once they start their move, is a lot quicker. The short passing is bang, 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 very snap, snap, snap. Although sometimes they do that and they just end up heading straight into people traffic. But what we've also got is, Trossard has been pushed further out wide again, where he'd started the season coming inside a bit more. Solly March is almost playing as an out-and-out winger. And what we've got with those two at the moment, and I don't think it's necessarily De Zerbi, although I get the feeling that Trossard is a lot happier moving further inside than he starts with. I mean, he's almost playing as a winger at the moment. But it's also down to their decision-making at a given time. Now, again, we've kind of... The season's already been cut in two, i.e. pre-Leicester and post-Leicester. And pre-Leicester, the decision-making was a lot more appropriate. It was better. It was a lot more correct. I mean, it was decent at Anfield. But the decision-making now, because their approach play, really good. They'll get to the choice of taking on a man or passing it, and that's where a bit too often it's falling down. And... The issue that I saw, certainly for the Forest game and marginally for the Brentford game, was a lack of form / confidence in effectively what was the front three. And I'm talking about March, Welbeck and Trossard. And like we said at the top of the show, they haven't become rubbish overnight. There's something there. And
this was mentioned by De Zerbi in one of his post-match interviews after the Forest game. Where he basically alluded to the fact that, okay, now it's my turn, because I think there's too much confusion, because when he came in, he said, I don't need to tinker too much because it's going well.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to put a little bit of my own personality on that team. But it's got to the point now where there's confusion. And I think that they need to go.
There is an error of confusion.
They either go De Zerbi ball, or they don't. Because, I mean, you know, they're intelligent footballers. And just to reiterate the fact, this is probably the best squad of players we've ever had at the club. Yeah. The most talented set of individuals and as a team together, this is the best team we've had, I think. And as you said, Al, that they haven't become a bad team overnight. It's just a case of what the manager wants. Because again, I mean, we've mentioned this on the show before, Justin, that it's unusual for a manager to come in when the team's being successful.
Yeah, he's having the you have a honeymoon period. It's like he's having a divorce period at the start because he's following on from very high success, and that is very unusual in the Premier League. Very unusual.
Yeah,
because there aren't that many managers being poached. I think it's almost as if there's a Big Six conspiracy to, you know, we've gone above our station as Brighton Hove Albion. You look last year at our two games at Chelsea, and we were, you've got to be really disappointed with two draws as a Brighton fan, because those performances were better than that. Chelsea are not mugs. They've seen that and they're kind of thinking, why on earth are Brighton playing like that with a tiny percentage of our budget? We'll have the manager. We'll have Cucurella. Spurs are looking, you know, we'll take Bissouma. Arsenal with White, we will get, no doubt, in January, there will be a lot of knocking on the door for players like Caicedo and Trossard. The Big Six are taking notice, and those absurd amount of money that they're throwing away for the players, I think we've got to get into that mindset that is now going to be a thing, because the club have recruited. We seem to have a lot of young potential that could, you know, can step up. Look at the bench, actually, against Forest. It looked like a bunch of kids on there. I think there's only Steele and maybe
Undar.
Very talented kids, but that experience thing is maybe... What I'm trying to say is that I think the Zerbi and the recruitment team need to do some work in January, because although we've got all this potential, I'm just worried about the sort of the here and now. And there is a feeling that the Zerbi is not too confident about some of these young geniuses like Sarmiento, or potential great players like Sarmiento and Ciso. And he's not really, potentially wants more of the experience.
To be fair, he's doing largely what Potter did, in as much as these kids are kind of knocking on the door of the first 11. But let's face it, at the end of last season, Potter didn't change the team too much. That was his top 11.
Yeah.
And that's largely it. And those kids are knocking on the door, and good luck to them. Absolutely. And De Zerbi's doing the same. At the moment, I feel he's kind of marking time while he actually gets his feet under the table. And let's face it, he's really got a job cut out to do for this week. But I take your point about the top six cartel. They saw what Leicester did in 2016, and between them got together and said, well, that's not happening again.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you consider the Agnelli family at Juventus, absolutely appalled that Leicester won the Premier League. They're thinking, who are they? What are they doing here? The Premier, the Champions League is supposed to be this elite thing, and who the blazes are Leicester? And yeah, the English sides have said, well, actually, yeah, you've got a point. And here were Brighton, little sort of upstart interlopers with, you know, really good stuff on the pitch. It helps that actually it's a very well-run club off the pitch, but that's by the by. Mm. So in the great scheme of things, although the results look a bit... So the number of people that actually judge how the club is being run by the results on the pitch, and not even necessarily the performances. Let's face it, against Spurs, arguably the better side. Against Brentford, the better side. Against Forest, the better side. It counts for nothing if you don't stick the ball in the onion bag, absolutely. But again, it's work in progress. I do take your point, AD, about there does seem to be an element of confusion. It's not as fluid as it has been. When they get going and start passing through, and they did it against Spurs, and Spurs are no mugs, when they got their passing together, it was absolutely wonderful. And it comes back to absolutely everything that we actually are talking about. It comes back to finishing.
It does. And this is, again, Justin, what you said earlier. I know we were talking about this after the Forest game, weren't we? That we're seeing McAllister and Caicedo, they're not as being proactive. They're not. I mean, there was a classic example against Forest where the ball was pulled back, and you would and Caicedo and McAllister were the second wave coming in to pick up those balls if the first wave had missed it, and they were too far back to even make a run. So it's I think it will come. I like to say it's not all doom and gloom. So I mean, you know, there's plenty more to come from this team, and again.
I would say this about those two. It's interesting you mentioned those two. At the moment, and here I'm about to praise them to hilt, and yet I did that with Trossard about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and look how his form has dipped. But with Caicedo and McAllister, at the moment, those are the two in the team who I trust at the moment best to do their job. They are solid, they are dependable, their passing is good, they get stuck in. And bearing in mind that the midfields that we've had over the past season and a half, this is yet another midfield duo that actually you can hang your hat on. So I'm just going to put it out there. For as much as people are moaning about the team, I think the Caicedo and McAllister are actually, you know,
they're players of the season.
At the moment, they're players of the season, and they're nowhere near hit tip top form yet. At the moment, they're in good form. Yeah. Justin, I mean, have you got anyone else to add to that, or can you look beyond those two at the moment?
I think Sanchez, he's done a couple of dodgy things, but generally he's been pretty good. Veltman would be another player that I think has done well with Dunk too. Welbeck has really now turned into a forward and not a number 9 striker, and he's doing a great job up there. But when you're getting a forward, when you're getting a forward sacrificing so much in terms of, you know, goal hanging, being selfish, Welbeck is the ultimate team player.
Yeah, and
what he's designed to do is to get other players scoring by. Yeah,
I mean, I've got issues with Welbeck at the moment. Not
go on. I thought he was your god.
I love him. There's no two ways about it. But basically, the last few games, he's been, and this is something we mentioned on there a little bit earlier on. He's been starting. He's been playing as at number 9. He's been playing very central, where previously he's been starting from wider, which actually gives to the central defenders more to think about, because if he's over there, I've got to go over there to stop him coming inside, and that leaves space for other players. So the fact is, with him staying central, he's not giving the central defenders too much of a headache, because he's right in front of them. They can see him. They can get touch tight if they want to. And he's much more effective coming in from the wide. And,
Think that's what De Zerbi has told him to do, though?
Well, definitely. Because, I mean, Danny was saying early days into De Zerbi's reign that he said what he wants him to do, and he wants him to play more centrally. And I can get, I'll be able to get a lot more goals.
Well, to be honest, he's had plenty of chances to do that. That's the point.
Yeah, exactly. His finishing's been absolutely woeful. I mean, Brentford, his finishing is just terrible.
Well, this is the absolutely point. There he is terrible. In the middle, effectively being a forward and a striker.
Yeah.
And when he's taking his striking role, well, he's on strike.
But this is what I was saying, that by starting him with him being given the option to drift wide and not hold that central position, he's actually giving a lot more scope for the central players to bomb forward into the space work that's been vacated, mm-hmm. because the defenders are worrying about Welbeck.
All I would say is the other thing that we've actually missed out on. I mean, admittedly, we seem to be talking Brentford and Forest as one sort of, well, two legs of the same game.
Oh no, we're going to come to Forest in a bit. Trust me.
I was about to say, because one thing that I think we certainly missed was Kaoru Mitoma as an option.
In a minute, but we've got to touch on something else first, Al, and that is the fact that you're listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And we are brought to you in association with the brilliant old footballshirts.com. And this shirt is just absolutely lush.
This is straight out of Mod Central.
This is a beauty.
Can I describe it?
Yes, you can.
Okay, well, it's long sleeved, which is incidentally something you realise you can't buy these days. Long sleeved, pretty much round neck, mustard yellow in every way that it's not a Paul Barber jersey, with two vertical stripes down one side, very mod-like. It's got a kind of about to be charging bull as a logo, as a sort of sponsor's logo. Conforama, I assume, is their sponsor. It's made by Le Coq Sportif, the sporting cock. The fact that it's made by Le Coq Sportif screams to me that it'd be French. The fact it's a bull says it's Spanish. So I'm going to go for somewhere in the Catalan region. Above and beyond that, matey, not a clue.
Justin.
Yeah, I you said a lot of what I was thinking, Al, actually. The French translation of the sporty cock. I would add to your mustard thing, that's Dijon mustard.
It's not English, right? Mustard.
It's not English, is it?
Good no. Mustard knowledge there, Justin. I mean, you know.
Does this mean it's from the city of Dijon?
That's what I'm going for.
On certain days, it will look more like a whole grain mustard, I'm sure. But it will be.
Yeah. Have you any idea who it might be, Justin?
No, I came to the same conclusion as you. The bull says Spain. The other elements say France. Yeah.
You know what I think it looks like?
Go on.
I know it's not, but it looks like the goalkeeper's shirt from Escape to Victory.
Well, that's what I'm saying about the two vertical stripes. Yeah. That shirt, both the goalkeeper and the white shirt, is a very mod shirt. And it was because that film was made at the time of the mod revival, 1981. But yeah, those shirts are classic mod shirts. However, AD, please put us out one.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is... Oh, did you want to have a guess on the year?
Oh, Le Coq Sportif, I'm going to say 85.
Justin?
79.
Well, you're closer, Justin, on this one. This is, and this is the 1974 to 1975 home shirt of Sporting Club Toulon, who play in Championnat National 2, which is the fourth tier of the French Football League system, and they play at the 8,200 capacity Stade Bon Rencontre. The club was founded in 1944, and they played under the name of SC Toulon until the 99 to 2000 season, when they were administratively reformed as Sporting Toulon Var. In 2016, Sporting Toulon Var merged with SC Toulon de la to become Sporting Club Toulon once again.
It sounds like, do you remember the that play from last year, It's a Sin, where they just kept going la? That's what you sound like.
After World War II, they joined the French second division, and they left for just one season in 1946-47. And after 11 years in the second division, the club reached the highest division in France in 1959 after finishing third in the second division, but were relegated the year after. Relegation seems to be a thing with them. They were relegated to the French third division during the 80-81 season, but they were growing stronger. And in the 80s, thanks to the effectiveness of Christian Dalgère as a forward and the talent of their leader Alain Benadet and the experience of Roland Coupry in defence, Toulon was once again promoted to the first division in 1983. And during the 83-84 season, Toulon stayed in Division 1 thanks to the 21 goals of Delio Ornis, who was the top scorer in the league that season. And the club reached the semi-finals of the Coupe de France, but were defeated by Monaco. The following season, they saw Toulon shining once again, and they were still third after 31 matches played, and they were then defeated three times in a row, including another defeat against Monaco, in front of 18,000 spectators at the Stade Mayol. Now, that's the Stade Mayol is where the Toulon rugby team play.
All right.
Why it's the bigger stadium. In 88, the Toulon team included Bernard Cassoni, Bernard Padot, and David Ginolard. And the former player, Roland Coupry, was their coach, and they finished fifth in the league, but failed to qualify for any European competition. Former players, of course, include the aforementioned Ginola, as well as Jean Tigana. And, of course, there is a link to the Albion with the renowned 50p head, George Santos. Santos joined the Albion in August 2006 after turning down an offer to return to former club Grimsby, something he later admitted in an interview as being the biggest mistake of his career. So there you go. Joining really Brighton instead of Grimsby is the biggest mistake of your career. There we go.
He really pulled up trees here, didn't he?
Oh, my God. He was, I mean, he was absolutely dreadful.
He was.
There was one game at Yeovil. We lost 2-0.
Yeah.
And he was just... God, well, the whole team wasn't great.
I can't remember which way round it was, but I think it was Sheffield United against West Brom where they had to abandon the game. And he was one of those that got the sent off. I think he came on as a sub, two-footed someone, and got sent off. And we were talking 20 seconds, top whack. I'm thinking, yeah, he's the bloke for us. Yeah, too long. I wasn't that far out. I mean, it's not quite... Catalonia, it's actually the, I think it's Department of Roussillon, so it's still southern France. So well done, Justin. Well done, me.
Yeah.
Nearly right.
I think. Well, isn't it the under 21 Toulon tournament?
There is a.
Isn't that where Bobby made his debut for the England under 21s?
Yes, he did. I think I've got a feeling it might even be the younger ones, and that under 17 certainly. Yeah. But yes, they have a. I think it's an annual tournament they have there. They play because it looks like one of those modern stadiums, but it's the kind of place that. Lou Macari tried to describe with Dean as being. And you can add to that the fact that no one ever turned up. Now, if there happened to be a European tournament in Brighton, even if it was just a bunch of under-17s, you'd expect at least a couple of thousand to turn up. But in these things, there's no one there. It's pretty shambolic, really.
Well, they were there. I can remember a couple of European tournaments in Brighton, particularly the Beach Football World Cup, which was... they had out down on Madeira Drive featuring the likes of Eric Cantona.
Alan I had
Stubbs
forgotten that.
Playing for England.
I had forgotten that, but yeah. No, so did you say that was a first team shirt?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was like.
It's a pretty sexy top, actually, isn't it?
It's good. It's nice.
It's a good one. It is a good one. And of course, you can see that. And all their other shirts, actually, over at oldfootballshirts.com.
You're listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb. Now, Radio Reverb is a community radio station. We are governed and by Ofcom. Don't let what was said on Channel 4 put us off. We're not allowed to say those kind of swear words. But seeing as we're not allowed to accept advertising, we can only accept funding through grants, sponsorship and donations. So... we do appreciate that there's a cost of living crisis going on and Christmas is coming and shekels might be a bit thin on the ground. But if you do get a moment and fancy helping keeping this brilliant community based project going, just head to radioreverb.com/donate, hit the donate button there and follow your nose there. And if you've got a couple of quid you can send our way, that'd be brilliant. It just helps to pay for our licenses. We actually offer training for anyone who wants to start their own radio show. If you've got an idea as to what you might want to do on Radio Reverb and broadcast to your contemporaries across the city, then we'd love to hear from you. The station would love to hear from you. They do offer training. And it's these kind of things which your donations will help go towards. So if you get an opportunity to do so, go to radioreverb.com/donate. And if you've got a couple of quid to spare, then that'd be brilliant. Thanks very much indeed.
Now, Justin, if a tree falls in the forest, does it hit the post? It was...
Now, does the referee let it stay on the floor?
Well, this is true. This is true. Actually, just before we move on, we have just got to touch on a couple of bits from Brentford, actually, which was, firstly, that sublime finish from Ivan Toney, which was, I mean, you know, sometimes
it was a bit sexy, wasn't it?
You just have to hold your hands up and say that was a brilliant, brilliant finish.
Yeah,
and absolutely brilliant winning of penalties. And
you know how much I hate the phrase "winning penalty," Justin.
Yes.
He won that penalty, didn't he?
Yes.
Don't get awarded penalties. He busted a gut to win that, didn't he?
Yeah. He did what it looked like it was planned, but he was in a position where he was in a
tell
position
us, Justin,
where
tell
it
us.
Was going to happen because you know there's an invitation there that was taken and he knew it was going to be taken and he won it, so
It was Peter. And more to the point, actually, just ask one last question about Brentford. What was their beef with Joel Veltman? I mean, it seemed to be that all of them were picking on him.
Well, I mean, that the afters was quite funny. That was right in front of us.
He didn't even do anything, did he?
Absolutely mental. He said, "I do not like it when they touch my player."
But that sounds a bit dirty, actually, especially the way you just did it there. You made him sound French as well. So it was in front of you. Did you see the red mist rising then?
I actually thought that there was going to be, I thought that, what's his face? Frank was going to, this shit is going to get red carded for it because it looked like he was actually going for him at one point. But it's really? Like, it was just silly. But, you know, I mean, it's just gamesmanship, I think. And Mike Brentford would get, you know, they were good value for it. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, if you want to have 72% of possession, 21 shots and goal, 7 on target, have I mentioned that? Not actually put the ball in the back of the net, then, you know, and if someone takes their chances, it's fine. But, I mean, just quickly, I mean, Tony, I mean, he is a decent striker. Is he going to go to the toilet? This is what we're now calling the World Cup, because the World Cup that shouldn't exist. It's the WC. That's what we're calling it. It's the toilet.
The WC that hasn't been cleaned off with bleach yet.
Do you think he'll go to the water closet?
Not unless he leaves Brentford.
Yeah, Southgate is a bit funny with the teams he picks from. I think there's a list of teams. It's kind of the top six, Villa and Palace. So seeing as he's not with any of those, I would doubt it.
But he's in the squad. And, you know, I mean, the way he takes a penalty is just... Well,
yeah, but he's got Harry Kane to do that, hasn't he? So,
well, you know, what happens if, I mean, bear in mind that the England captain's legs are made of glass. His ankles are made of glass.
So is his face. Having said that, I would say this. Ivan Toney does have the whinging, whining credentials to be an England player. He did like to offload. I mean, don't get me wrong. He looked like he was having a ball at the end of the game, but then his team's won 2-0. The ghost of Mopé's trolling is writ large through the Brentford Stadium, and that's fine. But when he's on the pitch, I mean, obviously he's doing his thing for the side, and good for him. And let's face it, we'd love to have someone like that on our side to be able to do that. And I'm probably somewhere down the line we do.
He would have scored against Forest in our team. That's
that sure. kind of thing. But, you know, it's... I don't like... I mean, I can't really think of any players that we have that spend their time moaning in the way that, we, you know, the likes of maybe Lacadia did or Andoni did, or there might be the odd one that I can't think of here and there, but, yeah, he whinged, didn't he?
Morpay certainly liked to have a little...
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah. And certainly Solly March, who still has that look. When he sits on the floor, it's like someone's taken a puppy from a child, isn't it? He just has that look on his face that says, "Oh, ref."
But I'm okay. Well, on the train on the way to the Forest game, there were some quite full of Forest fans. So actually, it was a really good turnout from them on a Tuesday night, I've got to be saying. But there was one of them who was singing, "How rubbish must you be, it's still 0-0. And that was an hour before kickoff.
They have, I think, already accepted their fate for the season. They seem to have, I mean, you've got shades of Fulham from about 2 or 3 years ago. They've got someone who, I mean, in talking to the Forest fans, and I thought they were good, you know, like you say, they were good value for their presence. You know, they said this, the chairman wants to win things, you know, win trophies. You think, great, like the optimism, like the drive, but let's do it with a sense of realism. I mean, you know, when we got promoted, was it the case that we were going to win the FA Cup the next season? You know, it's, they've got to sort of approach this with a bit more realism. And their chairman is throwing money around like confetti, having done so then gets rid of the people who have thrown his money around for him. They've got 150 new players, none of whom know each other, and it looks like a team in transition. This is going to take a bare minimum of a half season to get together.
And then basically they talk about getting rid of the manager, and they decide to give the manager a new contract and sack the head of recruitment.
Yes. which shows anything. Actually, the head of recruitment surely is the chairman who actually signed all these checks, kind of thing. So at the moment, this is a club that's actually preparing itself for next season already. And I get the feeling that the Forest fans have already accepted their fate because irrespective of the fact it's only the one match that we saw them play in, you know, they're already staring down both barrels, Justin, aren't they?
Yeah, I would say that, but I think the caveat with what happened last night was that Steve Cooper came for a point. He got what he wanted. We came for three and we didn't. So you're right. I can't see quite how they can. They might be able to low block their way to a few draws, but seeing them actually win a game, I can't see how that can happen.
One of our chances goes in, we rack up a cricket score. You can't go into games with absolutely zero ambition. You just can't do that. And it was
the most unambitious side. I mean, what is it now, our sixth season in the division? And admittedly, we've always been kind of one of the underdogs, even when we're playing, you know, sort of teams below us. You know, the likes of Everton, Wolves, Villa, they might have been below us, but, you know, they're still considered bigger clubs. And we go into those games and they're going to play and you realise actually they're not the force that they once might have been once upon a time.
Yeah, I mean...
However, go on.
There's a reason that the Premier League's regarded as the best in the world because, you know, like team... hashtag teams like Brighton, Wolves... Like Burnley, I mean, obviously Burnley aren't there anymore, but you know, they were a match for anyone on their day, and Forest. A Burnley team, regardless of where they were in the league, wouldn't turn up and just park the bus like that.
It's not even just parking the bus; they just parked it, turned it off, and then trashed it.
It was disappointing though that they were I mean, don't get me wrong, we didn't win that match because we didn't take our chances, but they were ably assisted by Mr. Darren England, the referee, who there was a point in the match where they realized that if the ball had been turned over and we'd gained possession, essentially they just needed to sit down on the pitch, maybe scratch their head, and Mr. England blew the whistle up for a serious head injury and stopped the game. That happened 3, 4, 5 times. Incredibly frustrating, that level of anti-football. And you can see they were taking it in turns to get the referee to stop the match at a critical point where we looked like we had the numbers to...
McAllister got booked for being fouled.
I think that was dissent. I mean...
He probably had a point, though.
It was horrific what was happening at that. It was like a sit-down protest. It's Brighton have got the ball back. I'm sitting down.
Nottingham Forest are sponsored by Just Oil, are they?
No, Just Oil couldn't afford their shirt either. So,
well, there is that. But, I mean, what this is just something that probably the first time I really saw it. It's what I would call doing a Warnock. And for those who remember the 91 playoff final against Notts County, and they were managed by Neil Warnock on that particular day. Now, don't get me wrong, we weren't brilliant, but any time we get a kind of a good head of steam going and we get a bit of possession together, down someone would go, there's an injury, and of course it stops you, interrupts your flow. For me, that was the first time that was actually done, and it's done under the guise of the phrase gamesmanship. Let's call it for what it was, rubbish. It's embarrassing, it's it's unprofessional. As that's the phrase that I was actually thinking of earlier as well, Justin. Anti-football, it's just pitiful, absolutely pitiful. That a team that's actually got designs on being in the Premier League and wants to be there, and they behave like that in order to scrap for the odd point here and there. Okay. I mean, you know, obviously things can change throughout the season, but as a club, as a culture, they've got to change because at the moment they are, well, nailed on for relegation, even in October. Their approach to the game is just horrific.
You know, you'd think I mean, their problem started last season anyway by having so many loan players. I mean, Cooper didn't. And, I mean, obviously, Chris Yeaton was there at the beginning of the season and they're in the relegation zone when Cooper took over. So he did a tremendous job pulling a team together to get them out of that division for the first time in 20 years. But obviously most of those players went back to their parent club. So, but I mean, just to throw so much lack of thought at it in terms of forward planning and just trying to just get someone, oh, he might have played in this league before. You know, I mean, a Rice or Zoria is a terrible player, but you know, it's just terrible. Anyway, let's move on from Forest. Let's pick out a couple of points from the game. There was signs of Adam Webster coming back to life, Justin. I mean, he's not had a greatest season so far. I mean, he's finding his feet again. But he was actually, the marauding Webster was back last night.
Yeah, I still didn't think he had a particularly good game. It was nice to see him getting forward. I think his natural spot or his best spot is the spot we play Veltman in at the moment. He's right footed, but he's got a brilliant left foot, and I think you know he goes in that, he gets put in that left centre back position because of it. I know we've got Colwell there as a bit of a sort of an insurance policy if something happens to Webster.
Yeah, he's injured at the moment, so
I would like to see the club invest in a proper replacement, a left-footed replacement for Dan Byrne, rather than develop a Chelsea player. But yeah, I didn't think he was. I thought there were some misplaced passes. I think he was lumping it forward. He wasn't finding his man. So I thought it was a bit scrappy, even though, as you say, he was getting forward and his shooting was on par with everybody else's shooting, which was a couple of feet over the bar.
Yeah. One person shooting out who actually, this has been a recurring theme over the last few games. And after such a sparkling start to the season for him, and he should have won the game for us last night, when that was Pascal Gross.
It's kind of interesting. You notice that he's actually been subbed in the past three or four games. I think there might even be an element of the fact that with De Zerbi wanting to play the game a lot quicker, and let's face it, Pascal Gross is not exactly noted for his turn of pace. You know, you're not going to mistake him for Speedy Gonzalez. So I'm just wondering if there's an element of games passing him by a little bit where at least there was a bit more of a considered approach to it from under Potter, which is when then Gross was starting to shine. That said, he can still stick the ball on a sixpence. And in that sense, for the dead ball stuff that he can contribute, then I've still got no problem with him. Mm. But let's face it, if we're going to criticise one player for shooting, then you're going to criticise them all, because to pick on one is totally unfair.
Oh, no, I've got a long list here.
Yeah. Does it go back as far as the likes of Teddy Maybank, maybe Malcolm Poskett?
No, it goes between February and April, mostly.
To be honest, and like I say, that was all of them. And unfairly, people blame Mopé because he was, quote, the striker. And that's when you get to realise when Mopé, you know, wasn't playing anymore and there was, and Welbeck was able to have a run of games, and you realise that there was this not this striker, there's this forward who brings players in, that everyone gets the opportunity. And this is where Trossard was able to shine, as was Gross. Mwepu and Caicedo have been brought to the fore on this. And yet, someone has stuck a pebble in their shooting boots.
Yeah. Justin, actually, going back to something we were talking about earlier, and it was again, you mentioned the bench against Forest. Now, obviously, previously, over the last couple of years or so, we really, really good on our forward planning, having someone's replacement already in the mix before, and then if a big offer does come in. But are you concerned about the lack of depth in midfield at the moment? Obviously, we lost Basuma and we didn't necessarily replace him, but now obviously we've lost Mwepu as well. If we lose, if one of Caicedo or McAllister gets injured between now and January, for instance, or gets injured at the World Cup, are you concerned?
Yeah, a little. I know we've got wee Billy Gilmore to come in as well, but he's very young still. So we're kind of missing that. We've got a couple of veterans in Lallana, and I think Gross is approaching that as well, then we've got a load of youngsters, and it's that sort of bit in the middle, age sort of 23 to 28, 29. We're missing those, really. It's players who have still got they've kind of got the pace of McAllister and Caicedo, but they've got the
players that would be at their peak.
So I think we've got a lot of, you know, there's great youngsters coming through. There's a Polish guy who seems to be doing quite well now over
Kozlowski.
He could come back in
Jakub Moda as well.
Yeah, I mean, poor Jakub. I think there's going to be a question mark over him until we see him playing again.
He's out until March or April at the earliest, yeah. So that's going to be a good year of him being out. And you know, then you know, come the following season, then hopefully he'll have a blank sheet of paper. De Zerbi will have someone else to look at. And we can take our view from there. Yeah. And the weird thing is that it's kind of maybe a bit of a moot point to do it, but it's I wonder if Moda had stayed fit, given how others around him have actually improved their game, well, until the last two or three games, but given how those around him have improved their game, would he have been able to have kept up? One would like to have thought so. But, yeah, one worries for him, but that's only because he's marking time rather than, you know, being able to make that progression while still playing. So,
well, let's face it, he would have missed as well. So, you know.
Absolutely. I think we all would, mate. I reckon De Zerbi would have done as well.
Okay. Well, let's have a quick look forward to the weekend. And I say look forward. Are you looking forward to the weekend, Justin?
No. And mainly because of one man. Or is he a man? I think there's only two sort of possibilities with this guy. Number one, he is genetically modified. So someone's been mucking about with his DNA. Number two, he's not of this world and he's some sort of alien. So he seems to be like, he's in terms of the qualities you want from a striker, it's like 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
For all of them. So where is his weakness?
Do you see him as a generational talent? I mean, obviously, I mean, you've got Messi getting older. You've got Ronaldo, well, non-existent anymore. I mean, who is the next generational talent coming through? Is it Haaland?
Yeah, but also he's a different player to those two. He is the best number nine for a number nine role that I've ever seen. Just because of what he can do, you try and find a weak. He's got all the physical attributes, but he's also got that thing that great strikers have, like Lineker and Shearer, and he can sniff a goal, and he's always in the right place at the right time. He's stunning at that, but because of his size and his power, defenders can't. He beats all defenders well. So we know that. If he gets a chance, he's pretty much going to stick it in. So our challenge, I think, on Saturday is how do we stop him scoring a hat-trick?
There's only one person I can think of who should be marking him. Sarah Connor.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week. So let's hope we're talking about an Albion victory rather than Haaland mauling. But thank you to Justin Brentnell, to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Bye.